no one turned round and asked me, why is he fighting? Why is he in front of the regimental sergeant major every Monday? Why is he in the jail? Why is he court-martialed? And I says, this is it, I'm caught. That's me, I'm out. I've lost my career, I've lost everything. I was questioned. And because I'd told so many lies, I was an expert in telling lies. I knew the facial expressions to make. I knew I couldn't stumble. I knew I couldn't repeat the same thing. So I got away with that. I have this rule now. Never judge anyone. Get to know someone before you can speak about them. Never tell lies. One of the biggest things I regret was the lie telling that affected my immediate family. Affected my mother, my sister, you know, everyone else that was involved with me who didn't know either. You know, because this still had a long way to go before I could be my authentic self.
Today we hear Doogie Morgan's story, a highly capable operational soldier who was also a disaster in barracks. Doogie and I served together for years in the Black Watch and the Royal Regiment of Scotland, and I thought I knew him well. But I didn't meet the real Doogie for more than 20 years. All that time, he was hiding a secret, one that, if exposed, could have cost him the job he loved, the life he'd built, and his freedom. Since leaving, Doogie has dedicated himself to helping others, including through his work with Fighting With Pride. But before we get to that, we need to understand where it all began. A quick note, this episode includes some strong language and topics that may be distressing. Please listen with care. Support resources are in the show notes and on our website. I'm Lindsay McDuff, the Culture Colonel, and this is my conversation with Doogie.
So when I was 15, I left school at 15 and a half, and I went to work in the paper mill in Inverkeithing. I had a small incline in my back of my head that was different. But growing up in the 70s and certainly the 80s, it was a no-no. I was in an all-male environment in the paper mill, and one of my colleagues turned around to me one night after a night shift. He says, Doogie, I'm going up to the Army Careers Office in Dunfermline. Do you fancy coming? He tricked me, Lindsay. He said, well, join the same regiment. And I'm saying, I don't know if I want to join the army. He said, I'll be fine. It's easy. You'll be great. But I got tricked at the careers office, you know, by getting put into the infantry. I didn't have a clue, infantry, signals, engineers. It wasn't very well explained in the late 70s. All they were interested in is getting a signature and getting you joined up. So eventually we joined the Black Watch, I did, and my mate joined the parachute regiment. I never saw him for about 15 years. The question is why I think I was testing myself to see if I was gay or different, knowing that the infantry units at that time were all male. So I think that's why I joined the army, is to get away from society. There wasn't many opportunities. I wasn't the brightest tool in the toolbox. It was very easy to join in those days. Hoping that it would tell me who I was. And it did, eventually.
I joined the battalion in West Berlin, and you had already been serving for a while by then. And you had built up an amazing reputation of being a highly professional, enormously capable, brilliant field and operational soldier and good at rugby. And yet you were an absolute disaster in barracks. You were in drama all the time. And that was a theme that stayed throughout your service, I think. So what's amazing is that you never managed to get discharged. I mean, you managed to serve for a full 38 years. And we might just delve a little bit into how you managed to do that and why it was like that for you.
Go back to 1987, Lindsay, when I was all that you said, and probably more. That wasn't the real me. Underneath the Doogie Graham that you knew, there was a serious side to me that I didn't like. I was drinking a lot. I was a corporal at the time, I was a full corporal. And I was in A Company, I always remember this. And my sergeant major at the time was a great individual who I'd known since 1979. But he also had his issues. And my way of coping with what my issues were was to drink. I was married at the time, Lindsay. I had a very young daughter who was born in Berlin. It was difficult because I'd been living as someone else for near on 20 years. That was me trying to create someone that I should never have been if I'd been allowed to be my authentic self.
I mean, I have to say, you did a brilliant job externally at hiding who you were, because you came across as being the archetypal soldier, and the fact that you were in the recce platoon and that's where the best soldiers went to showed that you were very good at this, and yet it was clearly all a lie.
I think I should have had my equity card. You become an actor. If I can just go back from 1987 to 1982, 83, when I was serving in Werl, West Germany, with the battalion. And that's when I really had to decide who I was and where I was going to go. And this was not without drama. Drama was probably my middle name at that time, because I was never out of the regimental sergeant major's office. Monday morning, tartan walk.
So we should just explain what the tartan walk is.
I can explain it very well, Lindsay, because I've got enough times I've done it to explain it. So this is when you get yourself into trouble, whether it's in barracks or out of barracks. And 9 times out of 10, it's usually to do with drink, fighting, being late, not getting up for a parade or a duty. And the regimental sergeant major, who is the highest ranking soldier, he is in charge of discipline. The Monday morning walk was everyone standing outside his office, waited to be called in to be disciplined. And in those days, the discipline was a little bit different to what it is now. And what I mean on is there was hands-on sometimes. But I was used to it, and I got to know what the answers was that they wanted to hear. The important thing is, Lindsay, about this point in my life, no one turned round and asked me, why is Dougie Graham drinking? Why is he fighting? Why is he in front of the regimental sergeant major every Monday? Why is he in the jail? Why is he court-martialed?
But do you think that was because it was common that people would be in front of the tartan table on a Monday morning and therefore you weren't any different?
No, I think it was the same faces, Lindsay, every Monday morning. You know, there were some soldiers who I served with at that time who were never in front of the regimental sergeant major. It was a culture and it was allowed. The more times you'd done it, the more that they got used to you and they knew that you would be there. But no, at one point, Lindsay, was I asked why. And it wasn't until a long, long time after that that someone asked me why. And by that time, it was too late. There was no interest. I remember when my father died. Lindsay, my father died in 1982, and I was only 21 years of age at that time. And the way they told me that my dad had died was, we were on parade, on muster parade. And muster parade's when you get up in the morning and to make sure everyone's there and they inspect you. And I always remember the sergeant major turning around and said, all those with a father take one step forward. Graham, stand still. So, of course, everyone with a father stepped forward and I'm still standing there. He says, your father just died. I was 19, 20 at the time.
That is just horrendous. I mean, I've heard anecdotal stories of that, but I've never met anyone where it's actually happened to. That's horrendous.
You know, that was a turning point, because a year later, my young brother took his own life by suicide. And in between that, I'd had 2 court-martials. Court-martials is probably the highest that you can go discipline-wise. And I spent a little while in the Military Corrective Training Centre in Colchester, which was meant to get you back on the straight and narrow. There was no alcohol within the sentence. You were working all the time. You were training all the time. And I remember coming out of Colchester and going back to the regiment in Werl in West Germany and moved another company. I think I'd had three companies in about 3 years, to be honest. Nothing had changed. I fell back in to my old ways, and I was meant to have been, you know, fixed, for a better word. I knew deep down inside the reason why I was acting like this. I just could not turn round and talk to anyone. And I had witnessed the second turning point, Lindsay. I'd witnessed four of my colleagues being ill-treated, beaten up. One of them had a noose round his neck and a big bit of 30-metre rope, and he was told to run up a hill, which was from the guardroom in Verrill, up the hill until it got tight. And I asked the question, why? And they said, because he's a poof. He's gay, Doogie. And you're not allowed to be gay in the army. Now, this is 3 or 4 years after I joined up, and I'd never known about that rule. It'd never been mentioned to me once. Would it have made a difference? Probably not. Because at 18, 19 years of age, you don't know who you are. You're finding your way, you're fumbling about, you're hoping you're someone else, and if you are a different person, then you're going to have to deal with it. So that was what was going on in my mind at that time. And when I witnessed this, I says, no way am I able to be my authentic self. And this is in 1983. So that was another turning point in my career.
So you were effectively forced to go inside yourself and start acting out to be the soldier that they wanted you to be. But that was clearly causing you tension and distress.
Yeah. I get quite emotional when I talk about these early days. It does get better. I promise you, it does get better. Yeah, I had to make a decision, and it was my decision, no one else's decision, for me to lead my life as someone that I was not. Buckle down, get on to. And it was an officer commanding of mine in A Company in Verrill who says, you're going on the advance party to Edinburgh. And he says, you're going on the junior NCO's non-commissioned officers course in Edinburgh, which means promotion, which means more money. I said, right, okay. He was very clever and he saw something in me. But he still wouldn't sit me down and talk to find out why everything had happened in the past. And this is now 1985. So I went back, done the NCO's cadre, and I came second. And I then went to the Close Observation Platoon to do a tour of South Armagh in Northern Ireland. However, at the time, my mind was spinning. I was still drinking, but I wasn't getting caught. Because I'm a little bit older and a little bit wiser, I knew that vodka didn't smell. So the next morning when you were on parade, they wouldn't smell the drink off you. And that was my way of coping and not getting caught of being still a heavy drinker. And it was hard. And still no one at this point would ask me, what is going on with Doogie? He's a great soldier, he's done this. We went on all courses, I got promoted, you know, to full corporal when we were going to Berlin, and that's when you joined. I was married. I can laugh about this now, Lindsay, but this was very serious. When I was in Redford Barracks prior to moving to Berlin.
That's in Edinburgh.
In Edinburgh, yeah. So this is early 1987. I'd just been promoted to corporal. I'd signed off the army. Signing off the army means I was getting out. I had a year's notice.
What was the driver for signing off? Was it because you were struggling with hiding who you were?
But then I had a change of mind after being interviewed by the Royal Military Police. The SIB, the Special Investigation Branch from the Royal Military Police in Edinburgh, chapped my door, as if to say, Sergeant Major's door, need to speak to Corporal Graham about this. So they interviewed me. And I says, this is it, I'm caught. That's me, I'm out. I've lost my career, I've lost everything. And it was because I had been seen in a gay bar in Edinburgh that they wanted to question me. Because in those days, Lindsay, they had the RMPs in plain clothes checking on the gay areas. There was a place called Fire Island, which was on Princes Street. And I was questioned. And because I'd told so many lies, I was an expert in telling lies. I knew the facial expressions to make. I knew I couldn't stumble. I knew I couldn't repeat the same thing. So I got away with that. However, I says, nope, I'm going to do something. There's something in the back of my mind that I didn't want to get out of the army. I want to prove something to people that you can be yourself and still be a good soldier. I'd been in contact with this female from Northern Ireland tour, and we got married. Went to Berlin, had a child, still drinking in the Cottle's mess, still not getting caught. Financially, we were struggling because I was spending a lot of the money. I managed to swerve people away from me. I was not a bully, but I could handle myself, and I used to use that as a get-you-out clause. This is 1987, going into 88, when you were in a battalion, and it was still this culture of, I don't care how much you're drinking, you just do that job. Just get on with it.
I mean, I remember when I was the adjutant and often saw you in the front of the tartan table still, because you were still drinking then, I wondered what it was, this sort of paradox between your brilliance as a soldier and yet your drama in barracks with the drinking. And I have a memory, and I don't know if it happened, but asking you why you were doing this. And I wondered whether you might not give me an honest answer because of the fear of what the policy said at the time.
You've got to remember, I was an expert liar. I vaguely remember, Lindsay, having this conversation with you. And I gave you the answer that you needed to hear, not the answer that I wanted to give you, because the policy was no gays, homosexuals in the British Armed Forces.
Sorry, and just to be really clear, there was no one in the battalion or the regiment that knew about your secret?
No.
The values that the army espouses, honesty, integrity, truthfulness, all of that, and yet you were being forced to give up all of that in order to perpetuate a lie because of the policy.
Yeah, that's what it boils down to. I always remember in Berlin when I was on duty, and I used to go down to a place called Summit House, where all the regiments in Berlin used to go and drink. And every Friday and every Saturday, there used to be a fight breaks out, and you had to go in there and break it up. I got talking to one of the barmen, and he knew. His gaydar, and although gaydar was not probably invented at the time, he knew there was something different about me because I didn't judge him of who he was. And every other person that probably after they had their drink used to call him all the names and all that. And it's funny, he turned around to me and says, "You're not the only one in the Black Watch." Really? And that stuck with me, and it still sticks with me today, Lindsay, that there was other people in the same region as me going through what I was going through, and they couldn't talk about it.
But you were doing it alone. It's incomprehensible. I mean, this is 20 years that you were doing this. In fact, longer than that.
The thoughts were never far away from coming to the front of my mind, Lindsay, that I needed to stop this. But I knew the rules, I knew the law, and I knew that I would be thrown out of the army. And I remember saying to one of my commanding officers in Purbright when I got promoted to colour sergeant, he says, "Dougie, where do you want to be in the next 2 years?" I says, "I want to be where he's standing," appointed to the regimental sergeant major. And this was 2 years before my 22-year point. And he says, "You don't have enough time." So there's me fast forwarding another 10, 12 years, Lindsay, that I had to live my life knowing I knew this time, I knew that was different. I had a son as well in between that. Marriage was not good. People say it was a sham of a marriage. No, it wasn't a sham of a marriage. It's something I had to do at the time. Was it the right thing? No, it wasn't. But I've got to live with that. This was going round about the 1989, 1990s, going into the 95 time. I had met other people, but non-sexual, because I was professional and I wasn't gay. So I was saying to myself, I'm not gay here.
You were convincing yourself.
I was convincing myself I was not gay. I've got to laugh at some people who say, really? Really, Dougie? And when I look back at the pictures, some of the pictures that were taken in the army, and I look at how I was standing, you know, and Graham now, my husband, used to say, come on, Dougie, look at you. Deary me. There's more gayness there than there is straightness there. But I never saw that at the time, and no one saw it really, because I was a good liar, Lindsay. I'd covered myself up so much. But going through those years taught me something. I have this rule now. Never judge anyone. Okay, get to know someone before you can speak about them. Never tell lies, because that's one of the biggest things I regret, was the lie telling. But it didn't just affect me, Lindsay. It affected my immediate family. It affected my mother, my sister, you know, everyone else that was involved with me who didn't know either. You know, because this still had a long way to go before I could be my authentic self.
The ban preventing gay people from serving in the armed forces was lifted on the 12th of January 2000. So it's 25 years ago. And yet you carried on living as a non-gay man for another 9 years, I think.
2009.
What was it that took you so long for you to become the person who you are?
I remember the day the ban was lifted, Lindsay, on the 12th of January 2000, because I'd followed the case of the four service personnel at the European Court of Human Rights in 1999, where they declared the UK government it was illegal, hence the reason the ban was lifted very quickly. And I remember being in the Sarts mess when everyone had to be told that the ban had been lifted, and the language, the anger that was still there. And I'm looking around saying, whoa, this is not going to change a lot. This is going to take a long, long time. I was part of 51 Brigade in Scotland at the time. And I was still drinking, Lindsay. I was really, and I was getting away with it. My ex-wife now, we had separated, but still living in the same house. And I was travelling through from Dunfermline to Stirling. It was about a 40-minute drive every day. I was part of the brigade recruiting advisory team, small four-man, four-person team. And we used to go about Scotland and brief up commanding officers on how to recruit. I always remember it, December the 5th, 2009, I come back from work and I was sitting in the room that I was staying in the house, and my ex-wife came in and threw an envelope onto the bed and says, you better read that. There's a little bit before that. We were separated and they still didn't know about my sexuality. But I decided then that it was probably safe to start working out who I was, where I fitted in to the LGBT plus community, because I then knew that's who I was. And I started to go onto apps. I was on there and I was chatting to someone who I thought was living in Devon, who was 36, I think I was 46 at the time, 47 maybe. And we were chatting away and there wasn't a lot coming back from them, but it was me that was doing all the questions, and there's pictures were sent. But after about 3 or 4 days, I very quickly worked out, hold on, this isn't right. And I stopped the conversation. But as I say, by that time there was messages, texts, pictures sent, and that's what was in that envelope. I thought it was a letter from my ex-wife's solicitor about the divorce, and I started reading the first page, and there's about 6 pages, and I went, oh my God. And it was all my messages and then the pictures, and a bit of me says, well, that's it, I've been caught.
It was a sense of relief at all.
Absolutely. I felt everything just flush through me. And I started to read, and then I noticed it was my ex-wife, my daughter, and my son that had set up this false profile and contacted me. The reason they knew that I was on this site was one of my son's friends had recognised me and told them. So looking back, I wish they'd come to me. Because it would have been so much easier to try and explain it instead of them catfishing me, because that's what it was. They catfished me. But relief, sense of freedom. And I remember it was really dark and it was pouring of rain. And I had a hairdresser's car, a wee green Ford coupe sort of thing. And I remember getting out of the room and started to go up to the loft to get a case. And I could hear the three downstairs. They started to come up and they said, "Well, is it true?" And I said, "Obviously. You know, well done. You've caught me. Absolutely. Now, can you just let me? I'm leaving. I'll get out of you, you know." So I managed to get away from the family home. I'd nowhere to go. My mother stayed just 2 miles down the road. I could not push this on to her. You know, we were just about to break up for Christmas leave. I had a very good friend who had a flat in Stirling. I knew he had two rooms, so I phoned him up and I says to him, "Look, can I spend the night? What's happened, Doogie?" I says, I've left the wife and kids. Absolutely, come through. And even on that night, Lindsay, when I went there, we stayed up till 2 a.m. drinking. I still never told him that I was gay. I was a warrant officer class 2. My warrant officer class 1 at the time says to me, "Doogie, we need to speak." He then noticed I was unshaven, I was bleary-eyed, and I was reeking. It's a good Scottish word, that, reeking, stinking a drink. And he says, "You're going to the doctors." And I take my hat off to that gentleman who just unfortunately died, a good friend of mine, and he was the first person ever in 30 years to notice that I had an issue and had a problem, and he wanted to help me. So that was the turning point in 2009, and that's when I became really, really involved in the, certainly the Army LGBT Forum, as it was called then. And I'm still not convinced that the military, the British Armed Forces, are 100% moved on from the homophobia. 2009 was the starting point of my getting better.
I mean, this is really just the start of the journey now. You've got to unentangle all the lying that you've done and work out how to live your life better. And as you, because you've been using alcohol as a coping strategy for decades, and the toll on your mental health as well, I suspect, was significant. So can you just talk through how you overcame those challenges?
2 days after I left the family unit, living on my own now in a strange place, Stirling, never been there before, I had suicidal thoughts. And with the alcohol and the pills, I was ready just to say, "You'd probably be better without me." And I messaged one of my friends and said, "Doogie, you need help. You need to phone someone." And I says, "Who do I phone?" He says, "Phone Samaritans." "Aye, okay, I'll think about it." And I had the pills there, and I know now, Lindsay, it was a cry for help. I just needed someone to sit and listen to my story so I could get it all out into the open and not have to tell lies anymore, not have to hide. 2 o'clock in the morning, I phoned the Samaritans, and I was on the phone roughly, I'll guess, maybe two and a half hours, and they were able to sit there at that time in the morning, listen to me babble out my whole life for the first time ever. And that's when it turned and says, "Someone is listening to me. I can be who I want to be without being judged." And on the 10th of January 2010, which was just over a month after I left the home, I was once again searching, and that's what we done, was on these sites, and this profile came up, which looked great. And I messaged, and the first thing I says, and this is my defensive mode getting in, I says, "Do not muck me about. I'm going to tell you I'm going through severe issues. I'm drinking a lot." This guy turned around and he said, "Well, listen, I'm going to a wedding this weekend." He says, I'll message you next week." I says, "Aye, okay." Never thought nothing of it. And he did. He got back to me. And when I asked him, "Why did you get back to me?" He says, "I could hear something in your voice, the goodness coming out of you." So there was a second or maybe the third person who would listen to me, who understood what was going through.
What's lovely is that that's Graham you're talking
about. Yeah.
One of the things that you do so well is storytelling. I've heard you say that talking is your therapy. it seems to me that there's two parts to that. There's the therapy you get yourself from telling your story, but also the other part is hearing others and providing support to them. And I think that's the kind of work that you're also doing with Fighting With Pride.
Men can cry as well, Lindsay. You know, men are, as I use the word stubborn, we're frightened to show emotion. I cry at the adverts on TV, God, you know what I mean? And you know, I'm a very emotional guy. And I try to reach out to people. Maybe their partner has messaged me. And these are non-LGBT personnel, Lindsay. And they say, Dougie, can you advise me where to go? Because I know what it's like to be in that situation, not to have any support. So I'll help anyone. But the biggest fear, I think, of men being honest with themselves and opening up is that they have to fend for the family. They've got to be the only ones. They've got to show no sign of weakness. And I now help other organisations. There's a man's health club. And this is all about being able to open up. But there's that one word against, Lindsay, is trust. These people won't open up unless they can trust you, and they can trust that you will not put this out to every, you know, Tom, Dick and Harry. So I know what it's like to be in there. I can empathise with them. I really can. My coping technique is me talking my story. So I'll go about and I'll go to big organisations and I'll talk about my story just like I'm talking to you just now, because there's people out there still not able to live their lives as their authentic self.
Do you think it's easier for younger men, particularly, to be honest?
There is a bit of the generation gap. You know, I was a baby boomer. These younger people still suffer in silence sometimes because they don't think that there's support out there for them. And sometimes it's too late. The generation gap, certainly within the armed forces, is getting better. I don't know if you know what Section 28 was. No one was allowed to talk about homosexuality in schools. And this generation have not lived with that. And some of them still to this day don't believe that there was a ban on homosexuals, on LGB, yeah. And not the T. Mm-hmm. I reach out to them and I help them where I can. My motto is leave no one behind. And I work, as you've mentioned, they're Fighting With Pride now, and I cover Scotland and Northern Ireland. On a day-to-day basis, Lindsay, there's people coming to me saying, I wished I could have been myself. These are veterans, right? And these are people I serve with. I think it's such a shame that we couldn't be that. But that was the government's rules at the time. And does it make it right? No, it doesn't make it right. But that's the way it was. Compared to where we are now, we do have networks who do support their LGBT plus service personnel. But there's still the fear with some areas of the military that still needs fixed out.
Yes, having spent years working in the diversity and inclusion space and particularly in the LGBT plus space, my observation is that there's been progress. I mean, and I'm not from the community, so this is my observation as an ally, I suppose, that there's been real progress. But at the heart of this is really a leadership function to ensure that everyone is treated equally and appropriately with respect. And yet there are pockets when leadership isn't effective or implemented well that there are risks of regression.
Leadership, we need strong leaders, definitely. We need strong leaders who will challenge. And I'm talking about leaders from the juniors up to our senior military personnel, including our civil servants and our members of parliament. We don't need stupid strong leaders. I'm dealing with the fallout of a young service personnel who took their own life. And it's all over social media at the moment, Lindsay, and it's really tough to listen. It's still going on. And some very good leaders who were wearing blinkers at the time, who were part of the stuff that was going on and who did not report it, who didn't have the strength to report what was going on. And this was part of the cause of the death of a service personnel, which is really sad. I was a good leader. I wasn't the best leader. I had my faults, but I could lead. I could lead from the front. Did I bypass some things? Yeah, probably, if I'm being honest. Did I report everything? No, I never reported everything. Did I report everything that I thought should be reported? Yes, I did. These youngsters nowadays are challenging everything, but we're still missing out. We still don't have this culture that we are able to lead our authentic lives. We've progressed miles. We really have. But
still work to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's fascinating to observe, knowing you over a protracted period of time, is how really different you are between the Dougie Graham that I knew well, or thought I knew well, playing rugby, and how you are now. First, it's clear that you're happy now. And secondly, the absence of the aggression that you had, that exuded from you all the time. I'm so pleased that finally you've come to this place where you're properly yourself and happy with yourself, because my word, it's been a journey. And for someone to have done all of this and to have overcome some of the challenges that you faced is truly remarkable.
People say, do you regret anything in life, Dougie? I don't regret anything, Lindsay. I might have done things slightly different, but it's all about when you reach that junction in part of your life. Do you go left or do you go right, or do you go straight on? And whatever way you go, then that's, you've just got to deal with that. You know, the anger was a huge part of my falseness. Mm. That's how I used to get away with a lot of things, by being angry. Mm. I've not given enough kudos to Graham. He coached me through the first 5 years. He saved my life. And he turns around and says, No, I never. He says, you saved your own life by listening to me. I said, but you listened to me. And he's heard it all now. And we've now been together 15 years. We've been married 8 years. My mother walked me up the aisle. We've had to move, Lindsay. We've been homophobically attacked in our own house in rural Scotland. But where we are now, and the life we've got, and the job I've got, helping others who didn't have any support for over 40 years, helping veterans get back into the families that destroyed their lives. It's amazing how people want to go back. It's all this big journey, this big circle, Lindsay, and eventually we've end up in a life that we are happy and we're content, and nothing now phases me. You won't hear me shouting now. I don't shout. Only when I shout four, or, you know, on the golf course, or not an angry man anymore.
It's been 25 years since the ban on LGB people serving in the armed forces was lifted. As Dougie says, yes, there's been real progress, but there's still more to do so that everyone can live authentically. What struck me most was just how isolating it was for Dougie to live as someone he wasn't, and the toll that that took. He's in a better place now, but getting here hasn't been easy. His story has a happy ending, in part because he talks about it, and I love that he now encourages other men to open up too, to be honest with someone they trust. What resonated for you? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Send me an email at theculturekernel@bfbs.com. Take care until next time.